time when the current generation's lifespan is said to be shorter than their parents. Enter Dr. Jeffrey Bland, known today as the father of functional medicine, which is a systems approach to health. His book is The Disease Delusion, and he writes, "We can now start to see the future of healthcare and medicine more clearly. We are moving from a medicine for the average to a medicine for the individual. We are starting to recognize that lifestyle, diet, and environmental factors influence how our genes are expressed into our health and disease patterns." Now, I know to many of us, this is not breaking news, but what Dr. Bland is sharing is improving lives everywhere. We can all learn something today. I'm Robin Clare. Stay tuned. This is Tributaries. Dr. Jeff Bland, thank you so much for joining us today.
Robin, it's such a privilege and a treat. Thanks so much.
Your work and focus is nothing less than a paradigm shift, which has been leading us into a much-needed medical revolution. And in the intro in your book, Mark Hyman calls disease a false idol, and your book is titled The Disease Delusion. I think that was a great place to start. Can you comment on that?
Yes, I certainly can. You know, first of all, I don't want to lead anyone to feel that we've been moving over the last 100 years in our medical technology in a completely wrong way. I think that the concept of disease had a very useful role to play in our evolving concepts of how people get sick and what to do both to prevent and treat their sickness. So I don't want to say that there is no value to the term disease. But as we have moved forward, particularly over the last 30 years, for the first time starting to understand the origin of our major chronic diseases, which are the things that cause more than 3/4 of our healthcare expenditure. And these diseases include things like type 2 diabetes, heart disease, arthritis, dementia, and digestive disorders of a whole range of different families. Those disorders, which are called chronic diseases, have been found to have very complex causes that are related not to a specific single thing, and therefore they represent themselves in a person with that diagnosis different from person to person. So let me use an example. Type 2 diabetes. We know that this is increasing exponentially both in the United States and globally. We might then think that this is a single entity. If you have the diagnosis type 2 diabetes as your disease, then you are treated as a type 2 diabetic like every other type 2 diabetic. But what has been discovered over the last 30 years is that this disease, type 2 diabetes, is really diseases. It represents individual different forms in different people, and it therefore is not treatable as a single disease with all people getting well by a single drug. And that concept that we've held, that a disease is kind of singular, that once we understand it, we can treat it with a single single drug or therapy, and that person will get well, and so one-size-fits-all mentality will work, just doesn't actually prove to be correct. And that is the difficulty, I think, with the term disease, because I believe that there is still a concept in society that if you get a diagnosis of a disease, in this case type 2 diabetes, or it could be rheumatoid arthritis, or it could be Alzheimer's dementia, that there will be a single drug to treat that single disease, that all people with that disease will get well. And that is just factually incorrect. And as we have learned then that these diseases are individual, it requires then a personalized approach, not to treat the disease, which is the signs and symptoms, but to treat the cause of those conditions. So we move upstream in our new medical world of the 21st century. We move upstream from treating the symptoms to treating the causes. And when we do that, we have personalized the approach to the individual causation in that person so that we get a much better outcome and we get less side effects and we get a much more efficient delivery of healthcare services, which saves tremendous amounts of money in this system right now that's very cost inefficient. So that's the theme of the disease delusion.
Yes, and I appreciate your integrity. Everything changes, and I think that's important to use what is historically a good idea and then move into some things that might be better ideas. I have a 10-line history of medicine from 2000 BC that begins and ends with "here, eat this root." I don't know if you've ever seen that.
Yeah, that's a beautiful little metaphor, isn't it? We started with that concept and we're going back to that concept. Yeah. Very interesting.
A big takeaway from Darwinism is survival of the fittest, which feeds a human lack of power or responsibility in a way. And the beauty of your work and the work of many others offers an unlimited opportunity. And so I'm wondering if you could share with us maybe originally what put you on the track toward functional medicine and then maybe roll into a definition of functional medicine.
Yes, thank you. I was a product of kind of a traditional biomedical education, like so many people who go on either into practice of medicine or into medical research. And I'm very pleased to say I was educated by people that I have high respect for that were highly acclaimed for their scholarship and their skills, their excellence. One of those mentors that I was fortunate to have that was really a major change in my whole life outlook was Linus Pauling, two-time Nobel Prize winner, who I had the privilege of spending 2 years working under at the Linus Pauling Institute of Science and Medicine in the early 80s. And that education really got me to more and more ask the question, why? Why do people get these illnesses? And the dominant theme throughout much of my educational experience, which started back, got my PhD in the 60s, so I'm a relic of that period. The dominant theme was it was in our genes, and that these were kind of hardwired characteristics. So we had the genes that gave us the risk to name the disease, everything from breast cancer with the BRCA1 and 2 genes that women may have, the mutated genes, to the genes that give rise to heart disease or diabetes or arthritis. And that was kind of the dominant theme, that these were genetically linked inherited diseases, which meant that we, as individuals, didn't have much control over it. They were just going to happen if we got the bad luck of the draw when the sperm met the egg and we were conceived. But over the course of my education and the course of the last 40 to 50 years, we've witnessed a remarkable change in our understanding. I call it a revolution in the understanding of basic biology. And that is that these genes that we thought were the characteristics that were going to give rise to our health and disease patterns as we grew older really only constitute in most people about 25 to 30% of the direct factors that control our health after the age of 40. That it's really the messages that we send to the genes. It's our lifestyle. It's our environment. It's our stress patterns. It's our exercise. It's our diet. It's the substances that we're exposed to in our air and water. Those are substances and experiences that modify how our genes are expressed. And the expression of our genes is what really determines how we look, act, and feel. That's called our phenotype. So our genotype, which is our genetic information that we have carried with us all of our lives, is not hardwired to produce our sickness. It is sitting there kind of waiting for the information it's going to get from the decisions we make about how we live, where we live, who we live with, and how we celebrate or don't celebrate life. And it's those genetic messages will then be translated into the things that become our function, become our mental function, physical function, our health function, our life experience function. And therefore, as this model started to evolve, I recognized that maybe medicine, the way that I had been trained, was very limited. Maybe we needed to start looking at a different model, which is to less focus on this hardwired deterministic view that genes cause disease, and really start talking about the factors that influence our function. Because for most people, the construct of keeping their function intact, which means their ability to do the things that they want to do throughout the course of 10 decades of good living, is the principal focus of what we call good health. And so from that, I started to really look at those characteristics that determine our function. And that then ultimately led into the development in 1990 of the Institute for Functional Medicine that my wife and I founded. And I'm very proud to say that since then now, that organization has grown to have over 100,000 health practitioners that have gone through its courses globally, and it's now published a medical textbook that's used in a number of medical schools, and it is really starting to become an agent of change in the way that doctors think about how they practice. And in fact, we have our first functional medicine clinic at the Cleveland Clinic in Ohio that is now actually treating patients with this new model, which I would have to say is producing extraordinarily good outcomes and much more cost effective than just waiting till a person gets sick and treating them with a drug to alleviate symptoms.
There is something that's called the 80-20 principle that was involved in the Genome Project. What was the big surprise for those that were doing the Genome Project, and what have you seen that's been positively gleaned from it?
That's a really, really wonderful question. You know, it's very interesting. You probably know about that metaphor that a lot of us talk about, of the person who at night loses their keys, and they're searching on their hands and knees for their keys and in the light of a street light, and a person comes up to assist them and says, "Can I help you find your keys?" And they say, "Well, yeah, please." And they say, and so that person starts to bend down into the light to examine the ground to see if they can find the keys. And the person who lost the key says, "Oh, don't look there. You have to look over there in the dark." And the person says, "Well, then why are you looking in the light?" And that's the person says, "Well, that's the only place I can see." Well, you know, this is a very, very interesting way that we often think about life, and the Human Genome Project is a good example of that, because when we went into the Human Genome Project and invested several billion dollars, the assumption was, the light, so to speak, was that we were going to determine, first of all, we're going to find about 100,000 genes, that was what was suspected in the human genome, and that we were going to find the genes that were broken, or what are called mutated, that led to the production of various diseases. So the drug companies were very excited about this because they thought, wow, with this information, we'll be able to design specific new family of drugs, each for different genes that are broken or mutated, and therefore this will be a completely new revolution for our business. And so as the Human Genome Project proceeded, you know, everyone was assuming that was going to be the light of our discovery. But lo and behold, that's not what was found. And for a lot of people, it was very disarming. And for those of us who look at it differently, it was very exciting. And so what was found? What was found is, at first, the number of genes in the human genome was far less than what was initially expected. It was not 100,000. It was more like 20 to 25,000 genes. Now, that's, for people who are not in this field, might not seem like a number they would particularly pay attention to. But 20 to 25,000 genes is actually much fewer genes in the genome of the human than you have genes in the rice plant or in the Pinot grape.
I know. That fact just cracked me up when I saw that.
Isn't that funny? And so you say, now hold it, we're a lot more sophisticated than the rice or sophisticated than the Pinot grape. I mean, in fact, you probably know from the human genome comparative studies, we're something like 97.6 genetically identical to the chimpanzee, which is a lot too close for comfort for most people. So, you know, what did we find? Well, here is the big aha. This is where we now, the keys were not in the light. The keys were over in the dark and a new discovery. It was known that the human genome is not just a bunch of DNA that's sitting in there that makes up our genes, but it's also a bunch of other DNA that's sitting in there that didn't seem to have any effect on making protein for the body. In other words, it was not genetic information to the extent that it was in the genes. And so people then called this DNA in the human, they called it junk DNA. And what it was suspected to be was just kind of artifacts from millions of years of evolution, that we just collected all this junky DNA they couldn't get rid of from relics of viral infections from past times and so forth. And there were a lot of us in the field who, you know, questioned this, said, now, hold on, you know, biology is generally pretty conservative. It doesn't carry a bunch of junk around with it over time. So just because we don't know what this does right now, to call it junk is a little bit presumptuous, because we may later come back and find out that this stuff, this part of the genome that's really not coding for genetic information, might have some function that's important.
Right. It's like a weed.
That's exactly right. And so, lo and behold, what has been found is that the biggest difference in the genome of a human than that of any other plant or animal is this, what used to be called junk DNA. And the junk DNA is not junk at all. It actually is what I call the executive centers of our genetic information. It's where the information resides that controls how all these other genes are going to be expressed in different cells at different times under different conditions. It's the upper executive branch of our genetic information that actually regulates how all of the other genes will be orchestrated. Like you need the great conductor of a symphony in order to play a Tchaikovsky suite effectively, no matter how good your violins and brass and percussion and woodwinds are. So the junk DNA is not junk at all. It is that which really differentiates humans from other plants and animals and gives us much finer control over how our genes are expressed. Now, here is the real aha of this whole story. It turns out that these executive centers, which are locked into what used to be called our junk DNA, are in direct communication with our outside environment, with what we're experiencing as human beings, light, air, water, food, microbial infections, viral infections, stress patterns, chemical exposures. All of those, what I call signals that we're getting 24/7 from our outside world, are being translated to some extent through this, what used to be called junk DNA, that then regulates how our genetic information is going to be actually expressed into our look, act, and feel phenotype. Now, this is the aha of the 21st century. This takes us from a view that we've had for the last 200 years, that our genes are fixed and deterministic, and we have nothing to do to control them. Whatever we got as the luck of the draw when we were conceived is just what we've got to work with, to where we now see that actually the regulation of how our genes are expressed can be controlled every day by matching our environment and lifestyle with that of our genetic goodness. And when we do that, we can shine the white light of good health, and we can turn off the darkness of disease. That is, to me, the 21st century breakthrough.
Yes, and it's, in a way, I don't know if it's called this gene plasticity. There's a lot of buzz going on, and certainly Dr. Norman Doidge has been a guest about his latest book about all of the neuroplasticity. Similar things regarding the brain functioning was thought that well, this function only can come from this one place and through these certain cells and all of that. And it's so exciting that everything's really getting opened up.
I think you just said it beautifully. You know, we have moved within the last 15 years from an era of what I call the age of the average, where we talked about people as part of the massified society. We were all kind of grouped together in this, medicine for the average, to where we've moved to the age of the individual, where we recognize that we are all uniquely different. We respond to our lifestyle, our diet, and our environment in unique ways, and our genes are there to empower our good health if we just send the right messages. And I think, you know, let me use an example of this that is probably on the minds of most people, and that's this recent kind of revolution of understanding about gluten and its effect on our immune system. I mean, here are these grains that we've been eating for a long period of time that we've considered to be very good parts of our food supply that carry a lot of good vitamins and minerals and fiber. So we talk about whole grains as being beneficial. And then suddenly we find out that there are those individuals who have reactivity to a protein, family of proteins actually, that are found in grains that are called the gluten-related proteins. And therefore they have this gluten intolerance or gluten sensitivity. At first we thought this was only related to a very small number of people that had what's called celiac disease. And this is a very extreme example of an immune response to the glutens in grain protein. And these people could get very, very serious diseases of the intestinal tract and elsewhere in their body if they ate gluten-containing food. So we said, yes, that does appear in some people, but it's very, very infrequent in a small number of individuals. Over the last 10 years, however, we've come to recognize that there are many more people than those that have celiac disease that have some degree of gluten intolerance. And therefore, it's not as isolated and infrequent that a person might have a problem in their immune system from consuming these foods as we once considered. Now, why has that suddenly been recognized? It's been recognized because we've finally started to move away from just the assumption that if the food is good for most people, it's good for everybody, to recognizing what the Greeks told us long ago, the food of one can be the poison of another, based upon your own individual uniqueness. So I think this is an example of this transition we are having right now in thinking, going from the thought of health of the average to health of the individual. And then we've moved away from this concept of medicine for the average to medicine for the individual. And that is to answer that question related to our each individual function. So once again, I come back to why we've been so interested in the concept of functional medicine, of really focusing on people's function, not just on what we call their disease.
Are the seven core physiological processes your contribution to the functional medicine system, or was it a basic format already that you drew into functional medicine?
Oh, that's another tremendous question. The way that the functional medicine concept emerged was, and I really give credit to my wife, Susan, for this. I had been doing a lot of traveling and talking and teaching and lecturing with doctors around the world for a number of years, traveled over 6 million miles. And she said, you ought to sit down with some of your great thought leaders and really ask the question, what would the best medical system look like if you were to start with a whiteboard with an empty piece of paper and just start designing what it would be? Because you've had the privilege, Jeff, of meeting some of the great thought leaders and thinkers around the world in biomedicine. So we put together for 2 years in 1989 and 1990 a thought leaders consortium where we invited some of the people that we had met that we thought were really from different disciplines doing things interesting in the area of healthcare. And we sat down actually in Vancouver, British Columbia, on Vancouver Island, Victoria, actually. And we spent 3 or 4 days, both in 1989 and 90, kind of with this concept of saying, what would the best healthcare system look like if we didn't have to worry about things like reimbursement and credentialing? And we just really talked about the fundamentals of what a good system would be. And from that emerged the concept of this functional medicine model. And in so doing, we all came kind of loaded with our research papers that we thought would describe what this kind of medicine would look like based upon what had been published in the medical literature over the previous years. And as we started to sort that literature, and we each, you know, had our favorites, so we had literally thousands of medical research papers among the group, we started to sort them into what we considered to be common areas. And when we sorted those papers, we ultimately agreed that they kind of sorted out into seven core piles. And those seven core piles were what we called the core physiological processes, and that breakdowns in one or more of those seven core physiological processes was what gave rise ultimately to the whole family of different chronic diseases. So these were kind of the explanations of the cause of the disease rather than just what we call the disease. So we started in 1991, when we formed the Institute for Functional Medicine, to really deeper drill into these seven core physiological processes to see if they really did represent, based on our understanding of human physiology and function, core principles. And over the last 25 years, the more we look and the more we deep drill and the more that is published in the area of research, both clinical and basic science, the more these appear to be really very fundamental core processes that underlie the origin of most all of the chronic diseases. So that's what we call the seven core physiological processes that are really kind of the cornerstone of how a functional medicine doctor is trained and thinks about the origin of health problems in their patients.
One thing that I really appreciate is that this work is really drawing in those mavericks from years ago, like Linus Pauling. You mentioned Linus Pauling, and so these early medical researchers whose work really weren't acknowledged now are fitting right into a new mainstream.
Yes, I think that is the excitement for me. It's a period of convergence. You know, I think what happened over the previous 50 years in medicine is that we got more and more into subspecialties and more into knowing know more and more about less and less until we know everything about nothing. That's a little bit of an exaggeration, but I think what we're witnessing right now is a different approach. We're witnessing people who are from all sorts of different disciplines with different specialties and different bodies of knowledge who are saying, you know, I can't answer all these problems with my own extraordinary knowledge in the absence of communication with my colleagues. I need to find other perspectives. I need to bring my knowledge together to really create a bigger understanding of why people get sick and what we can do about it, because the model that we're using right now is just not really working very effectively. We're still seeing a rising tide of chronic illness, and we're still not seeing people really get well. So I think that convergence has been a really extraordinary thing to witness and to be part of, because people are breaking down barriers and they're starting to kind of recognize that they can't be the answer all to all questions. And so we are seeing in functional medicine kind of a reflection of this. We're seeing people come from every subspecialty, from academic research centers to clinical centers, people who are family docs all the way up through subspecialists.
I like it. It's a good track to go down, individualized healthcare. More next week with Dr. Jeffrey Bland, father of functional medicine and author of The Disease Delusion. For any guest information, to listen to archives, share resources, and sign up for weekly programming, it's tributariesradio.wordpress.com. Podcasting on iTunes is at Tributaries Radio. I'm Robin Clare. Thanks for staying tuned.